Today at Reader's Corner, Susan Orlean, author of Rin Tin Tin, The Life and the Legend.
The original Rin Tin Tin was found in France in World War I on a battlefield in 1918. He made 27 silent films. All of them were huge successes. Rin Tin Tin also had a radio show. He traveled the vaudeville circuit. He did pretty much everything imaginable that an entertainer could do. The qualities that Rin Tin Tin embodied, this sort of heroic, steadfast, ultimate companion, that would always appeal to people.
I'm Bob Custer, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. For most people who watched American television in the 1950s, Rin Tin Tin was an exciting character on a very popular show. But as today's guest knows well, that television dog was little more than a fictional namesake of a real dog whose story and abilities captured America's heart nearly two generations earlier. Susan Orlean is the author of Rin Tin Tin, The Life and the Legend, a biography of this larger-than-life dog whose lore still survives thanks to the man who rescued him from a World War I battlefield and turned him into one of the biggest stars of the silent film era. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Susan Orlean. Ms. Orlean's book touches on a wide variety of topics to tell the story of Lee Duncan, the master and trainer of the dog he knew as Rinty, and their improbable rise and inspiring partnership. Susan Orlean is a journalist and a staff writer for the New Yorker magazine and has contributed articles to Vogue, Rolling Stone, Esquire, and Outside. She is the author of several books, including The Orchid Thief, which formed the basis for the script of the Spike Jonze film adaptation, and a 1998 magazine article titled Life's Swell that formed the basis for the 2002 surfer film Blue Crush. She joined us by phone for this interview. Susan Orlean, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Great to be with you.
Well, it seems there's two careers of Rin Tin Tin. The first career is a silent movie career. The second one is the TV career in the 1950s. Could you just sum up for us the storyline in both of these careers, the number of silent movies that were made, how long did the TV show go, why was this so popular in the 1950s? Give us some idea of who we're dealing with here, this larger-than-life dog.
You know, what's fascinating is there were even more than two careers, but just in short, the timeline was the original Rin Tin Tin was found in France in World War I on a battlefield in 1918. He began making silent films in the 20s. He made 27 silent films. All of them were huge successes. The first Rin Tin Tin, the puppy that was the orphan pup found by Lee Duncan, passed away in 1932. His son, Junior, took over, and he made a number of films. At this point, these were talkies, none of which were huge critical successes, but he continued the legacy. Then the third Rin Tin Tin, the grandson of that original dog, while he was not a movie star, he also had a great deal of celebrity. He was the U.S. Army's mascot in World War II and served as the inspiration and spokesman for the war dog program that the U.S. Army was promoting to get dogs for use in the war. He then was the existing heir to the Rin Tin Tin legacy when the television show began, which was in 1954. As it turns out, he was not the dog used primarily in the TV show. There were dogs that belonged to another trainer who were used actually in the show, but he appeared at a lot of the public events that took place constantly. There was a Rin Tin Tin road show in the 50s that was enormously popular. The TV show ran from 54 to 59, and it had probably the fastest ascent in the ratings of any television show that had been on the air up till that point. And it was such a success that it really turned the small network that it was on, ABC, into being, as we now know it, one of the major television networks in this country. I'm leaving out a few other careers, and this is part of what made this story so fascinating,
right?
Because Rin Tin Tin also had a radio show. He had he traveled the vaudeville circuit. He did pretty much everything imaginable that an entertainer could do.
So take us back to that World War I battlefield and this fella, Lee Duncan, who really discovers this dog. How does he discover this dog? And then what does he do with the dog? How does he get it back to America? What a story that is.
Lee was a young man in the U.S. Army. They were involved in some of the heaviest fighting of the war in the Meuse Valley in France. There was a battlefield that the Allies had just reclaimed from the Germans. And Lee, who was a fairly low-ranking gunnery corporal, was sent to investigate, just to go inspect this field after the fighting had ended, mostly to see if it would be a suitable landing strip for the Allies. Dogs were used extensively in World War I. So when Lee arrived at this battlefield and he saw a rather destroyed structure, he recognized it as a dog kennel. The German army used about 30,000 dogs in combat in the war. So obviously kennels were a very common structure in the battlefield. Lee went to inspect the remains of this battlefield, and he was a great animal lover. He grew up, had a very lonely childhood, had been put in an orphanage for several years when he was a child. His greatest attachment always was to his pets. So he went to look at this kennel, and entering it, he found that most of the dogs in it had been killed in the shelling. He heard a little whimpering sound, and he went to the far back corner of the kennel, and he found a female German Shepherd who had just given birth, and she had a litter of 5 puppies. Well, you're in the middle of a war, and you suddenly find a dog with newborn puppies, many people would take a deep breath and just think, well, this is not the time and place to have pets. But Lee, being as attached as he was to animals, he simply couldn't walk away. So he managed to get this female and her pups into his Jeep and returned to the barracks, where he was probably met with some surprise. Instead of bringing back airplane parts or bullets, he shows up with dogs. He found some other soldiers who were interested in having some of the dogs, and he kept 2 of the puppies for himself, a male and female. At the end of the war, the typical resolution of the fates of the animals that were in the war was that they remained in Europe, or frankly, they were killed. That was quite often the case. Lee simply couldn't leave these dogs behind, and he was first told that he absolutely could not bring them on the troop ship, and he begged and pleaded and found an officer who helped get permission for him to bring the dogs. It was very unusual, and I'm not sure what he would have done if he had been told he couldn't bring them on board. He was just that attached to the puppies at that point. And he managed to get them back to the U.S. and then later by train back to California, where he was from, with no goal in mind except having a pet and without particular notion that he would someday be the most famous dog in the world and that Lee would be a fixture in Hollywood. And none of that was on his mind. He was just in love with these puppies.
The first line of your book says he believed the dog was immortal. What did he mean by that?
When Lee first had the dog, the idea of this endurance and the immortality was far from his mind. You know, he loved dogs, and he now had some beautiful dogs that he adored. But once he came to Hollywood with Rinty, and the dog's success was so overwhelming, there was something iconic that the dog began to represent. And when Rin-Tin-Tin died, the first dog died, Lee began saying this phrase, which was fascinating, but also proved to be accurate. And I think what he was suggesting was that the qualities that Rin-Tin-Tin embodied, this sort of heroic, steadfast dog, the kind of ultimate companion, that that quality would always appeal to people, and that the figure of Rin-Tin-Tin, one way or another, was going to last forever. And interestingly enough, as strange as that assertion might sound, it turned out to be correct. I mean, the original dog died in 1932, and here we are many, many decades later with so many changes in culture and society and popular entertainment, and yet we're still talking about Rin-Tin-Tin. So Lee Duncan, in his own way, turned out to be prophetic.
Now, Lee Duncan, in his personal life, had a few bumps along the road, including a divorce. And we've all heard these stories of couples who divorce and the dog becomes the central issue. In this particular case, I guess it even went beyond that?
Yes, and this was something that I always thought was apocryphal until I found the actual documents proving this was the case. Lee got married to a woman named Charlotte Anderson. She was a very wealthy equestrian, and she sued him for divorce sometime later, claiming that Lee loved Rin-Tin-Tin more than he loved her, that he had no interest in her, that he didn't even like her horses, and that she named Rin-Tin-Tin as the co-respondent in the divorce, which is a category that's usually reserved for a mistress. I think she felt that Lee was devoted to the dog, and that was the beginning and end of his attachment, emotional attachments. And I would argue that this is perhaps one of the only times in a divorce case where the dog was named as the offending distraction from the spouse.
And Lee Duncan's daughter had some thoughts on this as well.
I think Lee was a very sweet man, a good person, but I think his ability to connect emotionally with people was simply never developed. And he got married again and remained married for many years and had a daughter. And I asked his daughter when we met, I was talking to her, and I asked her almost kiddingly if she ever felt any sibling rivalry with Rin-Tin-Tin. And I said it as a joke, actually. I thought, what kid would feel sibling rivalry with a dog? And she looked at me and she said, no, never. And I thought, see, I was right. And then she followed up and said, no, there was no rivalry. The dog always came first.
That pretty much sums it up right there.
Yeah, it really did. And while I think Lee was not a bad father, I think he simply just didn't have the capacity for a deep emotional connection to people. At the same time, he loved kids. He always had Boy Scout troops over to play with the dog, and obviously loved the fact that Rin-Tin-Tin was so popular with children. So he was certainly a man with a tenderness in him, but not a real ability to be connected with people.
So where did Rin-Tin-Tin, the name, come from?
A little bit of mystery here. In World War I, there was a story about a young couple who survived a subway bombing, and it became a kind of tale of survival that was very symbolic to people. And it was a boy and a girl named Rin Tin Tin and Nanette. And French girls and women began making little dolls, little trinket dolls, as good luck charms for the soldiers, and they named them Rin Tin Tin and Nanette after this young couple. So when Lee found the puppies, he named his pups after those dolls, as, again, they were survivors of a bombing. The real question is, where did the name Rin Tin Tin ever come from? And I really was never able to figure that out. I mean, the boy in this story was named Rin Tin Tin, but it's not a typical name, and I never was able to figure out anything other than the idea that it was sort of a nickname.
You're listening to Susan Orlean. She is the author of Rin Tin Tin, The Life and the Legend. So how did Lee Duncan get this magnificent dog before Hollywood? How did Rin Tin Tin get discovered, so to speak?
He was discovered in the most classic way, which was Lee took the dog and walked up and down Sunset Boulevard and knocked on doors at the studios and said, "My dog is smart and beautiful and can jump over anything and can play any part. Why don't you hire us?" Now, this sounds crazy, but this is a very different era in Hollywood, of course, where you could literally knock on the door of a studio. There were films being made all over the place, and they were much less elaborate productions than they are these days. So it's not as crazy as it may sound. And the idea of being in film was also not as crazy as it sounds, because at the time that Lee was going door to door with Rin Tin Tin, there was already a German Shepherd who was a big star in films. His name was Strongheart. And he was an action hero. You know, he was the equivalent of Spider-Man or, you know, any action hero. And he was a gorgeous German Shepherd who had been imported by a Hollywood director who had the idea that he would make a great figure in film. So Lee was very inspired by that and essentially stepped into those same footprints and ultimately pushed Strongheart out of public view and took over as the reigning champion of German Shepherd dog stars.
I guess you could at least argue that he had an even playing field with actors and actresses in the silent movies. Neither one of them could talk.
Precisely. You know, when it seems hard to imagine that dogs could have been as popular in film as they were in the 20s, but when you see those films, when you see the Rin Tin Tin movies, they're all performing with the same set of tools, gesture, action, expression, and the number of intertitle cards, which have dialogue, is really minimal. I mean, that was not how silent films worked. They really worked much more on the visual and relied on actors conveying to you what was going on by their face and their movement. And dogs were just, you know, were quite good at doing that as well. And in fact, I would make the argument that they look even more natural than people, because you aren't looking at the mouthing words and, you know, we know people can talk. So the fact that they're in a film but they're not talking is a little artificial, whereas dogs are behaving exactly as they always do. And they look very, very natural in silent film. And they, as evidence of that, their huge success in that era is clearly because they are very natural in a film that is based entirely on those visual cues to what's going on.
Now, some would argue, probably those who don't own German Shepherds, that all German Shepherds look alike. But in your book, you write about the very expressive face of this Rin Tin Tin that was in these silent movies, more arresting than beautiful, you say, his expression worried and pitying and generous. Do you think, is there any evidence that this dog's face, that particular Rin Tin Tin who was in these silent movies, was like singular in his attributes, his traits here? Or is this something that you're going to look at in the eyes in the face of any German Shepherd down the road in the business and say, well, it's a German Shepherd, has the same thing going for him?
No, he definitely had a distinctive face and expression and ability to convey emotion with his face that was very, very different from other dogs, and he was better at it than other dogs. And the funny thing, of course, about a breed of dog is once you begin looking at a lot of them, you realize that, in fact, they don't all look alike and that each one is very distinctive. Obviously, breeds of dogs have a general similarity that's powerful. But their faces really do look different. He had a face that even in photographs, you're struck by something deep and compelling in his expression. And you might say that he wasn't aware of that, and that was just the luck of a particular face and eyes and expression. But we projected onto him those emotions. The fact that he was so successful when there were 80 other German Shepherds making movies in the 1920s is, I think, proof that there was something different about him. And he was also an unbelievable athlete. He could jump and climb like really no other dog that was being used in movies at the time. And that made him a star. He had a kind of charisma that really is noticeable, and it doesn't require being a dog-crazed person or even a Rin Tin Tin fan to see that there's something about him that's very appealing.
Did Rin Tin Tin really earn more than most of his human co-stars, and I assume that must have made Lee Duncan a wealthy man?
He did. He was paid a lot more. For good reason. I mean, he was the leading man in those films. He was the box office draw. It made Lee a wealthy man. It also made Rin Tin Tin not very popular with some of his co-stars because, as you can imagine, they were a little bit peeved by the idea that they were getting paid less than a dog.
Now, obviously, dogs must die, and dogs die too soon, as all of us dog lovers can agree. And Rin Tin Tin died, and Duncan dedicated himself to keeping the dog's memory and myth alive. Was this just a calculated self-interest to keep in the money, or part of his grief-stricken days after the death of the dog?
You know, I believe, and I don't think I'm being naive to say this, I never got the sense that Lee's dedication to Rin Tin Tin was about the money. I think it was something far deeper than that. I think he really believed that this dog embodied something important. The connection with the dog had saved his life as a child. And he was such a clumsy businessman and so uncalculating in his way of making a living. I find there are moments when you just want to say, Lee, you should have franchised. You know, there were a million ways he could have been more successful.
Later, others did just that. By the 1950s, they had figured out all this franchising.
Yes, exactly. But Lee, on his own, was remarkably innocent in his way of going about things, to his detriment. As I noted in the book, he was so in love with the dog that he never sat down and thought, all right, let's see here. Rinty is 10. Maybe I should start breeding a dog who could replace him when he's too old or when he dies. He never even made an effort to trade on his fame and develop another dog for the movies. It was really all about him and Rin Tin Tin. And I think that, to me, suggests that his connection was really simple. It was that he loved the dog. He thought the dog had some quality that was exceptional, and he wanted the world to see it. And, of course, he enjoyed making a living. He enjoyed his period of time when he was very wealthy and living in Beverly Hills, although, honestly, he was a lot happier when he moved out to a ranch and was living the life that he knew as a boy, basically a cowboy life out in Riverside, California. So I don't see any cynicism on his part in his relationship to the dog. He would have probably had an easier life had he been a little bit more cynical and a little more calculating about how to maximize his profits. But he just wasn't that person.
So Rin Tin Tin died in 1932. How was that characterized or announced in the popular press?
When the dog died, there was a bulletin interrupting broadcasting, radio broadcasting all over the country, announcing this tragedy. The next day, there was an hour-long broadcast all over the country in his memory, all about Rin Tin Tin. There were obituaries in every major newspaper, large and deeply emotional obituaries about the dog. There was a real sense of grief. A lot of movie theaters hung pictures of Rin Tin Tin in their windows as if to note that something, some part of them had been lost. People really experienced it as a tragedy. There's a little bit of irony the dog was quite old at the time he died, so it shouldn't have come as a surprise, but he was still making movies. So I think nobody was really thinking of him as being the age he really was, because he was still in films, even though he was 13. It was really treated with a lot of sadness, and I think for a lot of people, too, it was the passing of an era, because he had been so strongly associated with the silent film era, even though he had transitioned to making talkies. I think the sense of who he was very connected to that period of time that had passed rather dramatically.
Well, now that you mention era, it does remind me that as I read the book anyway, you bring such rich context to your storytelling and to the periods involved here with the book. We don't have time on a program like this to cover things like the place of film in American society, the use of dogs in war, the relationship between peoples and animals, the celebrity and its myths, and all the things that you've discovered in this book. I'm going to leave that to our listeners, Susan, because we've run out of time for today. But again, you've done a great job with this, and I want to commend you for your work. Rin Tin Tin, The Life and the Legend. Thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
My pleasure. I really appreciate it.
Right. I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Susan Orlean. Next week, James Dodson, author of American Triumvirate, Sam Snead, Byron Nelson, Ben Hogan, and the Modern Age of Golf. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Mike Journey. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.